You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, it's a diplomatic duel at the United Nations.
This diplomatic procedure is running its course from our point of view, and until we receive an official response from official channels and sources, we don't consider this course finished.
We'll ask Daniela Pellard and Alessio Patilano how and why the US rejected an entry visa for Iran's new ambassador to the UN. Then we'll hear why South Korea's spy agency is in crisis, and ask whether an independent Scotland would necessarily mean a weaker and more vulnerable Royal Navy. And a little later in the programme, we'll look back on the life and career of the man known as the Branding King, Wally Olins, who has died at the age of 83.
The need for people to project an idea of who they are by me, by my stuff, I'm the one you should go for, gets more and more and more powerful.
All that, plus we'll check in with our man in Montreal and review the best bits from the world of folk music. So a very busy 60 minutes coming up right here on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. But before all of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
NATO's Secretary-General Anders Fogh Rasmussen has repeated his concern today over the actions of pro-Russian gunmen in eastern Ukraine and called on Moscow to de-escalate the crisis and pull back its large number of troops from the area around Ukraine's border.
I call on Russia to de-escalate the crisis, to pull back its troops from Ukraine's borders, to stop destabilizing the situation and make clear that it doesn't support the violent actions of pro-Russian separatists. Russia should stop being part of the problem and start being part of the solution.
Amidst the deepest East-West crisis since the Cold War, the leaders of Russia and the United States called on each other to do all in their power to avoid further bloodshed. Jordan's ambassador to Libya has been kidnapped by gunmen who demanded an Islamist militant be released from a Jordanian jail in exchange for the diplomat's freedom. The masked gunman shot and wounded the driver of Ambassador Fawaz Alitan's car as they snatched the diplomat from a street in the capital Tripoli. The kidnappers demanded the release of Mohamed Dersi, a Libyan Islamist militant jailed for life in 2007 for plotting to blow up the main airport in Amman in Jordan. Fierce battles have raged across Syria with rebel fighters launching offensive in Latakia, Damascus's eastern suburb Ghouta and Aleppo. The Syrian government claimed its fighters have recaptured the town of Maalula, but the United States dismissed claims by President Assad that the war is turning in his favour. British-based Syrian freelance journalist Malik Al-Abdi said there's a change of mood in Homs and Damascus.
There are ongoing negotiations now between the armed factions in the old city and the regime now to reach some sort of deal for Homs. And I think this is what Assad is actually referring to, this new mood in the country, which is we don't want the continuation of this war. We don't necessarily support the regime, but also we don't support the continuation of the violence.
Thousands gathered at Liverpool's Anfield Stadium today to mark the 25th anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster, in which 96 of their fans died during an FA Cup semi-final, one of the darkest days in the history of English soccer. The supporters lost their lives in a crush at Sheffield Wednesday's Hillsborough ground at the start of the match between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest on the 15th of April 1989. Australia has approved a $2.4 billion project to build a long-awaited second airport for Sydney. The city's current airport, Kingsford Smith, is 6 miles southeast of the city centre. A second airport for Sydney was first proposed more than 50 years ago. Prime Minister Tony Abbott announced the plan today, saying he expects work to begin in 2016.
We believe that this will lead to 60,000 new jobs in Western Sydney. It is essentially going to be an infrastructure package for Western Sydney, a long overdue infrastructure package for Western Sydney that does also involve an airport. It's good news for jobs And because of the importance of Sydney in our national economy, it's good news for Australia.
And finally, Munich is allowing people to get naked in public. Officials have declared 6 designated areas where naturalists are welcome to strip off without risking arrest. The city, the third largest in Germany, brought in the so-called urban naked zones after previous laws on nude sunbathing expired in Bavaria. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I'll have to quiz you later whether you meant naturalists or naturists, because I don't think it was I don't think it was the bird spotters who were being encouraged to take their clothing off. But
good
maybe
point.
We'll discuss that later
good
on.
Good point.
Yes, yes. You see, I'm listening to you. Well, anyway, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're going to be right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tóquio.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London now is 18:06, which means it's 13:06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Daniela Peled from the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and Alessio Patilano from the War Studies Department at King's College, London. Welcome both to the programme. Let's begin with our top story. Hopes for a deal on Iran's nuclear programme seem to be on a knife's edge after the move by the United States to deny an entry visa for the appointment of the ambassador, their ambassador, to the United Nations. We'll discuss this more in just a moment. To bring us up to date with all the developments, Monocle's Phil Hahn has this report.
It's a diplomatic disaster. The fallout continues to deepen after the Obama administration denies a visa for Iran's choice for UN ambassador. The US government said that Hamid Abutalabi would not be granted an entry visa over concerns he was involved with the 1979 embassy crisis in Tehran.
We certainly share the intent of the bill passed by Congress, as we have already told the UN and Iran that we will not issue a visa. We'll review the legislation. We're doing that now, and we will work to address any issues related to its utility and constitutionality.
It is a rare move by the U.S. to deny a visa for diplomats at the United Nations, and there are concerns this may set a dangerous precedent.
He is an envoy with good and positive experiences in various European countries and in Australia. This diplomatic procedure is running its course from our point of view. And until we receive an official response from official channels and sources, we don't consider this course finished.
The Americans have said Abutalabi was in a Muslim student group that was involved in the hostage taking and that he played a significant role in the mission. Iran denies the claims, saying he is one of the country's best-known diplomats. Iran has called for an emergency committee to look at the visa refusal, although a UN spokesman still hoped the issue would be solved between the two nations.
We have not been officially demarched or approached by either side, and we remain hopeful that it will be solved on a bilateral issue.
But with both sides refusing to budge, this diplomatic standoff could be a game of who blinks first. For Monocle, I'm Phil Hahn.
Well, Alessio, let's start with you. How important is this decision? You know, is it wrong of the United States, to take this move?
Well, certainly this is something that has a strong resonance within the United States. The Congress seemed to be quite reaching out to build up a relative large number of fundamental agreement as to they don't want this person there. And insofar as the national security of the United States is concerned, there is a point, because this person, even though, as it's been reported, was only involved as a translator later into the entire process. Therefore, it might have actually been a benign figure in the process, if you want. Still, his part is involved into an important case from the past that concerns the United States security. So, given also the current tensions that exist in the United States between the two parties, it seems that the Obama administration has relatively little sort of space to maneuver around this one.
Although it's unlikely, don't you think, that this gentleman's kind of background is so well known, he's probably like the least likely person Absolutely. That could get involved in anything in the United States.
Absolutely.
And Daniela, I guess the interesting thing is, you know, if another nation said to the US, please don't give this person a visa, we don't like them, we don't like their past, it's unlikely that any other person going to the UN would be evicted from the United States. The United States would say, leave the UN alone. So it's not a great precedent. It makes it sound like the UN is kind of there as a bit of a toy almost of the US in a sense.
Well, I can see the Iranians' point of view on this because it does set a rather unfortunate precedent. And I believe the law allows the US to deny entry, not just for security reasons, also for foreign policy reasons. That's what this is. I mean, my reading of it is that the Iranians intended his appointment to send a message, just rather like George W. Bush intended the appointment of John Bolton to send a message as UN ambassador in his time. They wanted to say, you know, all this rapprochement between our two nations, you know, steady on, actually. We've still got our hardliners, although the diplomat himself isn't a hardliner. I think they underestimated just how much the whole hostage and embassy issue still resonates in America.
But don't you think there's a point where you have to kind of, you know, forgive and forget? You know, we saw just last week, you know, The British Queen shaking hands with somebody who'd been a leader of the, you know, IRA, a leader who many people think was involved in all sorts of things, but, you know, was smiling, shaking hands, moving on. A member of her family had been killed by the IRA. Here we have, you know, the US. It's an event that took place a long time ago. On that idea of forgiveness, where do either of you feel on that? You
know? Well, you see, I don't think the problem here is that you don't have that sense of closure that you might have in relation to the other case that you just mentioned, in the sense that there is still, I mean, you're absolutely right, there is still an element there of tension between the United States and Iran. There is still a political game. So this is part of a political game that draws upon the legacy left from the difficult aspects of this relationship.
Daniela. Well,
but I think also we have to look not just at America's relations with Iran, but also Obama administration's relations with Congress. I mean, they haven't necessarily been too happy about his policy towards Iran. So this is quite a good sop to say we're having, you know, we're taking a bit of a robust attitude towards Iran. It's not all hearts and flowers. We're not leaping towards an agreement. Whether this even sets the scene for concessions in an agreement a couple of months down the line is debatable. It's not out of the question.
Also, there is an element here to consider because we're talking about this as if it were automatically going to set the precedent, and I'm not sure about it because the dynamics upon which the entire sort of exchange is being conducted, it does leave a door open for this to be a unique case. We're talking about something that is connected, resonates with the American domestic public. It is about national security. It is about foreign policy, and it is about one of the long-lasting, very difficult foreign policy relationship that the United States has. I mean, you know, Iranian-American relations are complex, are articulated. I'm not so sure there are that many cases out there that would just sort of bring about a similar type of situation.
Daniela, do you think that this kind of stymies the possibility of there being an agreement on, you know, on the nuclear deal that everybody would like to see happen? It seemed to be the one kind of possibility for, you know, Obama's foreign policy to actually work. Do you think that this jeopardises it? Or as you say, do you think this is actually part of a more complicated backroom deal?
We have been waiting for quite a long time for one of Obama's foreign policy moves to
He's not
to
having
work.
Much luck, is he?
He hasn't. And you kind of want him to succeed. I think there was a little bit too much euphoria over the Iran nuclear talks ahead of time. And up till now, they've just been kicking the can along the road, trying to delay any decisions. I don't think this has to have any major impact on the actual deal. My feeling about it is it's more for domestic consumption on both sides, both the appointment of the ambassador and the US response to his appointment.
Well, let's leave that diplomatic tangle for another one now and head to Afghanistan. The latest partial results point to a runoff between Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani in the race to become the country's next president. Daniel, let's start with you. How different of an administration will these two men possibly offer after Karzai?
Well, they are quite different. I think as far as the international community is concerned, they're both quite acceptable. They're both they're both very academic. One's an ophthalmologist, a former World Bank economist. Abdullah Abdullah, though, is a little bit more tainted by the fact that he has actually been in government in the last few administrations. So without casting aspersions on him directly, this kind of clouds the issues. Afghanistan is a very, very corrupt country. It's not just a question of the leadership being corrupt. It's one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And to succeed in politics there, you have to make all kinds of deals, have all kinds of allegiances. Ashraf Ghani comes to that in a bit fresher. The fact is, though, they're almost neck and neck now. What happens if there's a runoff is will be quite indicative, because the person in third place, Almai Rasool, supposed to be Karzai's chosen successor, he's also a Pashtun, like Ashraf Ghani is a Pashtun. So what may have happened is that they split the vote, the Pashtun vote, because no self-respecting Pashtun would vote for Abdullah Abdullah, even though he's half Pashtun himself. In a runoff, Ashraf Ghani might be quite likely to edge ahead.
Alessio, do either of these men hold out the possibility of holding together a united country and kind of finding some end to the battle with the Taliban, and also kind of presenting an acceptable face to the West at the same time, do you think?
I don't think that is the case, actually. I'm not, insofar as Afghanistan is concerned, I think that the past few years proved that the situation is consistently getting worse. Corruption is still very much looming at large. Insofar as the actual security from a hard point of view, there isn't any hope. I mean, as soon as the coalition forces, ISAF, started moving out, as soon as troops started being reduced, the internal cohesion of the Afghan security forces to keep the country together was very limited. I know that Donatella is looking all a little bit puzzled.
I think Danielle wants to. I think she's slightly disagreeing with you here. What's your take on? Let's be honest. It is not a good situation there at the moment, and security is is getting worse. It does not feel a secure setup
in some places. I mean, we've had quite a few high profile attacks in Kabul that have attacked foreigners and international institutions ahead of the elections. But I think we have to look at how successful the elections were across the country. I mean, they really were phenomenally successful. There was very little violence. There was a huge voter turnout in places where hardly anybody voted in the last time round. And the reports of corruption and fraud that I've been reading, I mean, there have been reports, but don't forget these are also provincial, local elections, mostly related to that. I feel incredibly encouraged by the attitude of the Afghan people turning out to vote, and also by the performance of the security forces. You know, I was ready to be as cynical as anybody, but the fact is that the vast, vast majority of security has been transferred to national forces, the police, the local, the national police, the army, and they ensured security.
Can I ask either of you, perhaps you, Alessio, Hamid Karzai steps out of the picture. He's been a strong man in many senses of the world, but while presenting a kind of quite an acceptable face with that cape and that hat, he's kind of had some kind of soft power appeal in the West somehow. But, he's kind of turned against the West, and now we have these two other people coming into the mix. Is there a sense that he will still be involved in everything that goes on? That, it's a slight transition of power, but as you say, there's so much brokering between, the tribes. Is this man a Pashtun? Is he not? Do you get any sense that there's going to be a real transition, a different Afghanistan after the vote?
I think the point that Daniela was making earlier on about the fact that this new administration will have to show itself as different from Karzai is actually very important, in the sense that, yes, Karzai has been there for a while. It was the option that provided a number of sort of guarantees, but it wasn't the ideal option. We know that under his administrations, there was substantial elements of corruptions going on at the government level. level and throughout the region and provincial sort of structures. So it is very important to have a clean start. And so the new face of the president will have to showcase that in a way of consolidated all the important gains that we've mentioned right away. That being said, I think there is still an enormous amount of challenge waiting ahead. First of all, insofar as all the areas that border with Pakistan, which are under no control of the Afghan security forces, and the Afghan security forces do not possess the capabilities.
Pakistan's security forces on the other side.
For that matters. And the other thing is also how to develop the relationship with the Taliban. And so in this respect, these two issues need to be addressed.
Daniel, just quickly before we move on that question of, you know, the Taliban, does anybody coming in, are they at least a little bit free of the baggage of what's come up to here and they can have a bit of a fresh start?
I don't think it's a matter of a fresh start. Karzai is not going to disappear the scene. I think more concerning, if you're talking about peace talks with the Taliban, I think the likelihood of the Taliban wanting to talk to Abdullah, who is from the old guard, who represents Massoud and the Northern Alliance from those, is very, very unlikely. I think the idea of reconciliation talks much more likely with Ashraf Ghani.
Okay, well, we're going to leave it there for a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Daniela Pellard, and also Alessio Patilano.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Daniela Pellard from the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and Alessio Patilano from the War Studies Department at King's College, London. Let's head now to South Korea for a look at a spy scandal that is gripping the country's intelligence agency. 3 officials have been charged with conspiracy to fabricate evidence against a man accused of spying for North Korea. And it's not the first time the National Intelligence Service has come under fire. Let's say this is a serious revelation. What's happening here, do you think?
Well, obviously, in a situation like the one that sees, you know, North Korea and South Korea standing next to each other, intelligence plays a very important role. Because formally, the two countries, even there is a ceasefire, there is an armistice, but actually, it's still at war. And so, for many, many decades, intelligence operators in South Korea played a very important role in 2 ways. 1, monitoring what was happening in North Korea, and 2, also keeping South Korea together. As, in fact, you know, President Park's own father was assassinated by a conspiracy that was brought together by intelligence operators from his own apparatus. And ever since then, so as South Korea entered a different sort of more democratic dynamics politically, obviously there were a number of reforms that were carried out. But the old way of doing the sort of networks, relationship that were so important in running the intelligence apparatus in the old days, they're not entirely gone away. And so I think this is a case. And recently we've seen a number of reforms that had to be carried out precisely to try to reduce this type of activities, this type of conduct.
Daniel, I was just looking here. Park Geun-hye, the leader of South Korea, has said that she apologizes to the public for their practices that have been going on within the National Intelligence Service. As Alessio was saying there, it does seem to be like an organization almost out of control, not under the control, certainly, of the government. And we forget, actually, that you know, it's not that long ago that Korea had a kind of military setup.
Exactly,
it's only been a kind of a modern democracy for a short period of time. Do you think that it just needs one of those kind of quick bouts of, you know, actually we need to change the way this is run a little bit around here?
I think that's exactly the case. This is South Korea's a very lovely democracy now, but for many years it was run as a military regime. But I think the situation here is quite similar to that experienced in other countries, where the security agencies for a long time have said, OK, leave it to us. We're going to look after national security. And while liberal journalists and academics such as ourselves would probably say when it comes to civil liberties and national security, well, we're not going to prioritise the latter. It's very important. We have to defend our rights. The security services are not really too bothered about situations like that. And when you have quite a significant bogeyman like North Korea just across the border, you know, it adds weight to the security services argument that we just need to, we can't operate with one hand tied behind our backs. But I think this idea of oversight, this idea of scrutiny, is really anathema to security services. But it's one that is happening, you know, all around the in all democracies, really.
Well, we're going to go now to another country that is divided north and south with a tense border between the two of them. They're not sure whether to be a united country or stand divided. It's England and Scotland. The First Sea Lord of Britain's maritime forces has said that a yes vote would damage the effectiveness of the Royal Navy and that would harm the security of Scotland and, of course, the United Kingdom. Alessio, fair comments, or is he just trying to stop the Scots going their own way?
No, I think it was about time that actually a senior figure in the British military word came out and put it plainly in clear sort of statements that this entire idea that underpinning the sense of independence, the debate about independence, it's a bit of a joke sometimes, because insofar as defence is concerned, you can't just turn around and split the resources the way they were, because the organisation of the bases, the capabilities, the logistics, everything that concerns UK security is spread across the country based on the assumption that it is a country. So it's not just a question of the day after independence is reached, well, you can turn around and say, like, okay, that base, I don't really like it because it's got Trident in it, let's shut it down. Selling this as part of this idea of, oh, don't worry, vote for independence and everything will become better, is a bit of a lie, because the UK has, as a nation, has important NATO commitments, which the nuclear deterrent is part, and it has also a number of important international commitments that would be affected. So the negotiation would be, you know, hard and long.
Daniel, Alex Salmond has made clear that he'd get rid of Trident. He's going to spend it all on, I think, on children and dental care.
Or children's dental care.
Yeah, on children's dental care.
I think they need that in Scotland with all the sweets there.
Yeah, well, I think he probably gives sweets to all as well. But on the serious question, he's saying that Scotland won't be protected because the UK as a whole hasn't spent money on traditional things. They should have a few more ships and a few more guns. But on the whole, he's kind of presenting an image of a country that doesn't need that much military protection. It's going to be like the Monaco of the North. What do you make of this battle, between Westminster and Edinburgh?
Well, I think he's slightly barking up the wrong tree when it comes to the idea of defence is not really going to sway people's votes one way or another. I think it's about the economy, it's about the currency. I think it's also about David Cameron, because the more David Cameron goes on about how much the Union should stay together, the more the Scots want to vote to get away. I mean, I think he's shooting himself in the foot here. Perhaps if he keeps quiet a bit more about the referendum, they might vote to stay.
Well, it is a kind of impossible situation, isn't it? Let's say if he speaks up, if the British government speaks up, then there is this kind of reaction, as everyone said. But if people like the Navy and the Army keep quiet as well, it sounds like we're not that bothered about it. Mm. So they're in a kind of a bit of a bind.
No, absolutely. And I think that's why I said that it was so important for the First Sea Lord. And it is. I think what is important to stress it's that the First Sea Lord came out and say that. So he's the man that is responsible for the main platform that delivers Trident. And here is not just a question of basing the subs one place or another. It is about the infrastructure behind it. It is about the people that run the bases. It is about the facilities to man them. I mean, we're talking about cutting edge technology that is particularly sort of unstable if it is not well looked after. So you can't just turn around and say, oh, that's not a problem. The day after the independence is coming around, we can dismantle the whole structure. That is not the case.
Well, I think Alex Salmond said he'd like to keep all the military bases, please. But he doesn't want to have Trident. And he believes that they would have access to fighter jets and ships. But, well, we'll see. He's going to be giving out more sweets, I think, before then. Anyway, gentlemen and ladies, we're going to have to leave it there after causing all that trouble. Daniela Pellet and Alessio Pasolano, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, don't go away, because there's lots to come here on the second half of Midori House. We're going to check in with our man in Montreal. We're going to review some music from the folk scene. Oh, yes, we are. And we're going to look back at the life and career of the king of branding, Wally Olins. But before we get started on any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Andrew, thanks very much. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen has repeated his concern today over the actions of pro-Russian gunmen in eastern Ukraine and called on Moscow to de-escalate the crisis and pull back its large number of troops from the area around the border. Amid the deepest east-west crisis since the Cold War, the leaders of both Russia and the United States have called on each other to do all in their power to avoid further bloodshed. Jordan's ambassador to Libya has been kidnapped by gunmen who demanded an Islamist militant be released from a Jordanian jail in exchange for the diplomat's freedom. The masked gunman shot and wounded the driver of Ambassador Fawaz Alitan's car as they snatched the diplomat from a street in the capital, Tripoli. Fierce battles have raged across Syria, with rebel fighters launching offensives in Latakia, Damascus' eastern suburb Ghouta, and Aleppo. The Syrian government claims its fighters have recaptured the town of Maalula, but the United States dismissed claims by President Assad that the war is turning in Assad's favour. And thousands have gathered here in England at Liverpool's Anfield Stadium to mark the 25th anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster, in which 96 of their fans died during an FA Cup semi-final, one of the darkest days in the history of English soccer. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. The time now here in London is 18:32, which means it's 21:32 in Moscow and 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now for us to head across the Atlantic, but a bit further north. We're going to Canada. We're heading to Montreal, and joining us is Patrick Pittman, who's our man in the city. Welcome to the show, Patrick. Now, I think we've got a challenge on, because we're going to explain some very complicated stories in over the next 10 minutes. Let's start with the election fallout in Quebec. We've just been discussing, you know, Scotland's ambitions for independence, but here we have Quebec, which really, after this election, is kind of saying, let's just stop talking about this for a while.
This is the Quebec independence referendum. You know, journalists had taken to calling it the never-endum over the years, but seems like maybe it's kind of actually met its end. The Parti Québécois, this has been their mission since the 1970s, and they lost to such a resounding level that it just looks like that's a generation done with now.
And why do you think that, you know, Canadians who live in Quebec have had enough of it? Is it just because it keeps on going to the vote and every time it kind of loses out and they want to get on with other business? Or was it because, you know, the party leaders are just not that very inspirational?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both of those. I mean, these things, every time it does come to a referendum, it really does tear Quebec apart. But, you know, the issue never really goes away day to day here. But that, at the same time, nobody was really showing any great vision for what an independent Quebec might look like. I mean, part of the problem here was that the Parti Québécois hadn't really intended independence to be the main issue of this election, and they sort of just stumbled into it and couldn't get themselves out of it. So, you know, they were just talking about how borders might work, how currency might work, and it just didn't really seem thought through.
And Patrick, tell me, you know, you're an outsider who hasn't been in Montreal that long. You've been there a couple of years. But as you live in that city, do you also get a sense that actually it kind of functions a bit as a separate part of Canada anyway? You know, it speaks its own language. It's very strict about how that is implemented. That maybe they kind of feel a little bit separate anyway, and they don't always need these additional political powers. Just give us a little bit of a snapshot what it feels like as an outsider being in Montreal.
Well, it very much doesn't feel like being in Canada, in Montreal. I should probably also point out that being in Montreal is very different to being in the rest of Quebec, is the sense of these things. But, you know, it does work pretty well here. It's a very separate identity to the rest of Canada, but commerce flows freely, and most Canadians are pretty strongly bilingual, and though the language entirely changes when you cross the border into Quebec, you know, it feels like there is kind of an ongoing interaction between the two. But, you know, you don't see much English language here day to day. There are some tensions about that, but largely in Montreal that works pretty well.
Now let's look at that divide and that separateness, because, you know, Quebec has had a little bit of a controversy with Ontario. This is to do with this story about Lev Tahor. Can you explain that for us?
Okay, so this is an ultra-Orthodox Jewish sect who were based in rural Quebec until late last year. And they fled their homes in the middle of the night and they crossed the border over into Ontario. They were fleeing a child protection case, which was alleging many issues, amongst them the fact that the children in the sect were being homeschooled poorly and there were severe hygiene issues, some allegations of underage marriage as well. They were going to be forced to hand several of the children over into protective custody in Quebec. However, they fled to Ontario, thus bringing up those judicial issues there. And now an Ontario judge has said that the sect doesn't have to return the children to Quebec because there's no jurisdiction to do so.
But that means that these kids are now scattered all over, aren't they? I understand that some of the children at the heart of this case have ended up in Guatemala, some of them now obviously in Ontario. So is there a sense that this has a good resolution, or is it just actually that, you know, both provinces in the end couldn't resolve it?
Yeah, there's no good resolution here as yet. This sect have, they were initially based in the US before fleeing to Canada. The rabbi that founded them is a refugee with refugee status from Israel due to his anti-Zionist views, he's claimed. And, you know, there's a whole mess going on here. And in the middle of it, there are several children who nobody really knows what to do with or how to care for, and a sect who's being fiercely protective of them.
Now, this is a hard story to make fun, but we're going to. Tax, Canadian tax. Why is this top of the news agenda?
Canadian tax sounds like possibly the most boring story ever. Doesn't it?
No, but that's why we're going to put the fun into Canadian tax. We can do it. Come on, let's go.
Okay, so the Canada Revenue Agency have become one of the first major organisations, I believe, to disclose an actual breach as a result of the Heartbleed bug that we've been hearing so much about.
And this is actually information has been stolen. And do we know how many people have had their information pinched?
Well, the agency is saying so far approximately 900 social insurance numbers they are certain were stolen during a six-hour window before the site was shut down and fixed. But the victims of the theft don't know exactly who they are yet, so it's hard to say who that is. And the reason they don't know is because the revenue agency is only going to tell them by registered post. They're no longer trusting the internet for anything.
Okay. Well, it's a vote for the postie anyway. That's one good thing. Patrick, thank you very much for coming on the show. That was Patrick Pittman, who's our man in Montreal and the only man in the world that can make Canadian tax sexy. Up next, we're going to be looking back at the life of the branding king, Wally Olins, and we'll also review the week in folk music. Oh yes, that's all to come in this episode of Midori House here on Monocle 24.
It's a green thumbs up from us for Tokyo's leading flower market and auction, where merchants indulge in the business of buying blooms.
The Japanese flower market is the place for perfectionists. Anyone looking for a branch of cherry blossom just before it flowers, or a blemish-free orchid with every flower facing the same way.
Blooms or Bust, a photographic essay on the Ota flower market, now showing in the film section on monocle.com.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay. For Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. It's time now for us to look back at the life and career of a man dubbed the Branding King, Wally Olins, who died on Monday at the age of 83. He was the chairman of Saffron Brand Consultants and headed Ogilvy and Mather in India, and was also one of the world's leading experts in branding and identity. He is most famously remembered for rebranding British Telecom into BT, as well as launching another telecoms company, Orange. He was also a good friend of Monocle and Monocle 24, appearing on many of our shows over the past 2 years. To look back on his storied career, I'm now joined on the line from our Zurich bureau by our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Tyler, sad news about the death of Wally. Can you just tell us how you first got to know him and what kind of man he struck you as?
I came across Wally in a number of forms. It seemed that you were either suddenly presented with Wally on stage at an event to talk about, you know, branding, and that could be, of course, you know, the development of a logo around a company, Andrew, or it could be, you know, talking about the whole notion of nation branding. And as we know, and anyone who's, of course, been following the career of Wally Olins, you know, here is someone who was, you know, very involved with Poland. He'd been involved with India, with a number of countries. And so a lot of times people have looked to others when they think about nation branding. How do you give a country not just a new coat of paint, but how do you give it a completely new raison d'etre, a totally new mission? And Wally's been a big part of that. So, and a gentleman that I've, you know, probably known now for, I knew him for probably the last, you know, 2 decades, and just, you know, such a strong fixture, not just, of course, on the branding and marketing stage in London, but certainly globally.
Well, let's just hear a little clip of him talking about how you give a brand a story.
A brand gives a personality to an organization, but you have to decide what your personality is. What is my personality? What do I stand for? If I stand for Grundfos or B&O, if I stand for very high quality, then that must be seen throughout everything I do.
Tyler, him in a distinctive form there, always very clear about what he believed. And I always love the slight air of indignation in his voice as well.
Yeah, there's always a sense of this outrage, no matter what he was talking about. And I think that was also the appeal, Andrew, that he had to companies, because I'm sure there's no shortage of CEOs who were confronted with boards and probably, you know, very scary numbers that they had to achieve. And of course, they would go and they would run a competition with a variety of different agencies. And then you had this very straight talking gentleman who could just get up in front of not just the CEO, but the CMO and talk complete sense, and having that tone of voice. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, we just need to get on with it. And this is how we're going to do it. And I think he was very, very good at just cutting through all of the marketing speak.
Well, certainly it was completely jargon-free always in everything that he said. Now, as you touched on earlier on, he was very interesting for the work he did do around nation branding, something that's become very important to us here at Monocle in everything that we've done, from the soft power survey to looking at how countries represent themselves and sell themselves around the world. And he was a pioneer in this field. I think that many people hadn't really thought about nations having brands, and certainly he carried on that work with Saffron. Again, a bit of a leader here, don't you think, Tyler?
Absolutely. And by just, you know, the notion of hanging out your shingle and saying we are going to be, you know, a business where we're not going to just talk to you about what should the livery for your aircraft be or what should the reinvented logo be for your telecoms company, but also should you think about what you look like on the world stage. So yes, you might have a flag that flutters above headquarters and above embassies around the world, but do you need to look different on television? And when you're on television, you know, how do you animate? What is the jingle sound like? And I think he was very good at that. And I think always a little bit, you know, a step ahead. It's very interesting. One of the most interesting projects he did at, you know, at Saffron was the work that they did with the airline Vueling. And, you know, this is a carrier. It's now under the umbrella, of course, of the parent company of British Airways. And it's suddenly becoming, you know, a bit of the darling of the aviation scene. A lot of people thought, oh, here's a Spanish low-cost carrier. Is it going to have much of a future? Now everyone is looking at, you know, the CEO. But I think not just that. They're thinking, here was a great brand that was a little bit ahead of its time. But it's something that I think has really sort of added value to, of course, British Airways' parent portfolio as well. So, you know, absolutely brilliant work that he developed and delivered there.
Well, let's just quickly hear Wally talking about that significance of nation branding.
In a globalized world, you would think in theory, in principle, that competition between nations and competitions between cities and competitions between regions would be less, because globalization means that the nation means less. It's absolutely the other way around. What has happened is that because the nation competes with every other nation commercially as well as in every other sense, the need for people to project an idea of who they are, buy me, buy my stuff, I'm the one you should go for, gets more and more and more powerful.
There he was, Tyler, talking.
Well, sure, words never spoken, right, Andrew?
No, exactly. Can I just speak? It's a small point, but I think one of the most wonderful things about Wally is, you know, that here's a man who understood branding. His personal branding couldn't have been executed better. Here's a man who, I think of him in my mind, I see a bow tie, I see a pair of perfect spectacles, a jacket worn just so. He had a really amazing personal brand as well, didn't he?
Well, he did, and you should always, we can't forget also, Wally wears your hat, because whenever we'd come into our building, you would always have people on our reception desk sort of scampering around to find out, you know, if it was in winter, it'd be, you know, a felt hat. If it was in summertime, it would be a straw number, maybe a bit of a Panama hat. And so, as you said, there was just, you know, always a, you know, not a too perfectly tied bow tie, because, you know, he would have, you know, walked across the park to come to our office. But there always would have been, you know, an absolutely fantastic jacket. And absolutely, I mean, this is a gentleman who not just, you know, made a mark, and I think that is often sometimes I think the problem as well, and maybe why he worked so brilliantly, because, you know, sometimes we do come across people in the design and marketing world, and you do wonder if they have a mirror at home.
Yes.
And then here was clearly a man who definitely had, you know, a mirror, I'm sure, on his way out of the office, not to mention when he left his apartment in London as well.
And a testament to kind of what it means to carry on working, because this is a guy who has been working right up to the end. You know, I saw him in the street only a couple of months ago. I saw him in a restaurant drinking heartily perhaps 6 months ago. A proper man who lived life and continued working. But to come back to his legacy almost at the end here, Tyler, I guess that thing you touched on, the simplicity of his message, I guess that's the thing that we will reflect on, because today we see so many agencies who wrap themselves up in lingo and clever speak about apps and gosh knows what. But here was a man who could cut to the chase. And I guess that in a way, that's why many other younger people did kind of look up to him as well, because he had this career, he had longevity, and he had kind of dodged so many corporate bullets along the way.
Well, I think that was the key part of it, Andrew. And I think you can sort of look back at all of the, you know, the various, and I don't just want to bring it down to logos and color tones. It's more than that. But I think also he really spoke sense, and not to bring it back to our own business, I think he loved what we did. I think we definitely struck up a great, you know, friendship as individuals and as companies, because, you know, in the same way that, you know, we like paper and we try to, I think, also, you know, speak sense, that resonated with him. And I think that's why he wanted to come in and have conversations, you know, about, you know, the state of nations, where the world is going. I think also how, you know, we observed, you know, the evolution of brands. And I think that's what, you know, he'll be remembered for. And it's, you know, and it's something which, you know, of course, you know, his influence, you know, certainly, you know, speaks volumes around the world.
Well, Tyler, thank you very much for joining us. That was, of course, our editor-in-chief, Tyler Relay, joining us from Zurich with the sad news that Wally Olins, the master of branding, died on Monday at the age of 83. And you're listening to Monocle 24. And welcome back. It's 18:48 here in London, which means it's 19:48 in Madrid, and it's 20:48 in Baghdad. Well, we're going to now do our weekly reviews, or our day's reviews, and we're going to the world of music, because joining us here in the studio is Howard Monk. Howard is the man behind The Local, a company that promotes events around the UK that touch on folk, jazz, acoustic, and even the spoken word, treading that fine line between experimental and accessible music. Welcome to the show. Is that a good billing?
It's not bad at all, actually. I didn't send that over.
We write these scripts ourselves. You know?
Anybody would think that whoever wrote that had been to all the shows.
So just tell me, The Local. You go into other people's spaces. You put on events around the country. How does it work?
Exactly that. We're a promoter. We're a movable feast. We organise events in different venues. We book tours for artists. We look after artists' interests. We consult with brands. We organise. We're very much operating in the live music space.
And we're a little bit of spoken word mixed in as well. Is that because you do festivals and all sorts of things?
Well, exactly that. I mean, spoken word is something that we have a regular event at the Ace Hotel in Shoreditch in London. And we've been putting on a spoken word artist as part of the normal music billing. It's kind of come from, I was a compere, and I still do that job. And if there is a compere, I think it's very easy to just insert something and say, everybody, listen to this.
Now, how many of the bands are we going to hear are actually represented by you? Is it 100%?
No, nepotism is...
There's nothing wrong with nepotism. I just want to get it clear before we start.
It's 50-50.
Okay, 50-50.
But then 100% are all going to appear at events that we're doing
soon. Okay, of course, all roads lead to The Local. So let's start with some music then. We're going to just start with Talk in Colour. And just tell us a little bit about this and why you chose it.
It's a new artist that I'm aware of via... I do a little bit of work with Ruth Barnes at Amazing Radio. She's a very good A&R source for us. It's a fantastic new band, UK band. And this is a brand new single. This is actually not even out yet. It's going to be out in 2 or 3 weeks. They're playing at the Ace Hotel, as I was just mentioning.
And they're called, this track is called The Cell, is that correct?
It's called The Cell with Talking Colour, yeah.
Well, let's have a little listen to this first. So what can you tell us about Talking Colour? It's a female lead vocalist. How many other people in the group?
To be honest with you, I don't know.
Okay.
I like the sound of the music and I put it on I'm curating that event with Ruth Barnes, and so we've shared the
So we've got this build as a combination of electronica, post dubstep, jazz, folk and indie. That's quite a mixture.
It is, and it's a little bit outside of the comfort zone of what The Local is known for. We're known for sort of experimental new folk stuff. And but that doesn't limit us at all. And of course, we work at festivals, we book festival stages, and so we've got a very Catholic taste. But I'm really excited to go and see them live. I haven't seen them play live. That's going to be really a superb show.
We're going to jump on. But before you do, just tell me then, what is, if you can, in a sentence, tell me, what is folk music now then?
Oh, goodness. It's,
How do you recognise it when you hear a song? You think, okay, that's in my world.
I didn't recognise folk music in Talking Colour just now, to be honest with you. It's it's a very broad church, but it's also, it wouldn't be quite as synthetic sounding as that. But clearly, she's got a great voice, and if that was a purely acoustic track, it would sound very good in that. With that backing as well, but I think it's far more traditional. It's far more storytelling. It's far more of, I guess, what you would expect. I've once said and been chastened for saying that all music is folk music to an extent, and I will still stand by that.
Well, that allows you to put everyone on, doesn't it? Okay. Well, let's see if Tiny Ruins can find a space on the pew in this very broad church. This is then with Me at the Museum. Let's have a listen to it first, and you can tell us a little bit about it.
Nobody feels old. Cold in the wind.
Super nice. That must say folk on the tin.
It absolutely does. But then it's very bluesy as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very bluesy indeed. And I think it's important to recognise that a lot of the youngsters that are making folk music or folk-influenced music these days have perhaps grown up with punk rock or with dance music or with the grunge or whatever it is. And so they're revisiting that in a way. And so you can't unhear what you have heard, but you can then bring all your influences to the table.
Now, so this is a New Zealand outfit. It's a songwriter, Holly Fulbrook. And we've also got here on...
She's on an aeroplane as we speak.
Is she?
From Kuala Lumpur. And she might be waiting at Kuala Lumpur, but she's playing in London on Thursday.
Oh,
night.
She's heading this way. She's not fleeing from you.
She's arriving. She's going to do a whole bunch... She's doing a couple of small headline shows of her own. She's going to be a member of Neil Finn from Crowded House's band, and she's opening for Neil Finn around Europe.
Brilliant. Well, we've got two more we're going to try and fit in before the end of the show. So let's move on. Jack Cheshire, who's he?
Bath-born, London-based Jack Cheshire. Singer-songwriter. However, this is an interesting one. It's very important to listen to Jack with the band, with the accompaniment that you're going to hear him with now. He will play on his own, and it's great to hear him do that, but I think it's really crucially important. He's a singer-songwriter in the general tradition, but he's chosen a jazz trio to be his backing band in this on this recent album, and it is awesome.
Well, this is Gyroscope.
Strange feelings in this place. Jumped from the moving train. I am the gyroscope that keeps spinning round and round. I am the gyroscope that keeps spinning round and round.
Well, that was Jack Cheshire and Gyroscope. And tell me, so you're promoting a lot of these bands, a huge amount of talent. You know, we've just heard, you know, three bands with great voices, you know, great guitarists and things involved. Is there a kind of a world that they can make a career these days? You know, because as we know, it's very difficult to make money from sales of, you know, of what you might call records or even downloads. Is there money made from, you know, appearing at bars and appearing at hotels?
There is money made in per territory, and there is money made even for folks who are not even close to being household names. It's a tough game, like it is. I don't think it was ever any different, but I think if people are strategic about it, and they'll, you know, I think it was Nick Cave. Somebody attributed it to Nick Cave, who said you need 50 people who are prepared to spend £1,000, or 1,000 people who are prepared to spend £50 on your art per year, and you have a career there. But I think that's possible to find it in different territories. You could have, you know, I've got artists, for example, Holly Tiny Rooms, who was played just previously. She's playing a bunch of shows in the UK, then she's going to go to France, then she's going to go to Germany, then she's going to go to Switzerland, and small amounts of money, you know, small artists. But then, you know, I think it is very possible.
And the robustness of the festival circuit and the growth in smaller festivals, I guess that's the kind of the world that these people are kind of travelling between.
Absolutely. During the summertime, artists will switch into festival mode, and they'll want to play all and every one that they can. A lot of the new artists want to stick around and hang around for the whole weekend at the festivals, but the more professional ones will play three festivals on the same weekend and then pick up the
fees
that are possible.
Apart from popping down to the Ace Hotel here in Shoreditch, is there any other kind of events that you've got lined up over the next couple of months that we should keep an eye out for?
Yes, absolutely. We've got Servant Jazz Quarters for Tiny Ruins on Thursday night. We've got also on Thursday night Eyes and No Eyes at the Shacklewell Arms. We've got a Shush Festival, which we haven't discussed, all-day festival of quiet music in a beautiful church.
And what is quiet music then?
Non-genre specific, just quiet. It doesn't matter. It can be electronic, it can be jazz, it can be folk, it can be pop music, but it's just got to be quiet. It's really an instruction to the audience to shut up and be quiet and listen to the music.
So is there no beer served at that?
There is beer served at it. And the music,
you take the lids off first.
Yes, they have to, otherwise the servers are shot.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. That was truly great. That was Howard Monk, who is
thank you for having me.
The man behind the local with his pick of, well, folk music and much, much more. But that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Daniela Peled and Alessio Patilano, who talked us through the US decision to deny Iran's new ambassador to the UN an entry visa and whether an independent Scotland would mean a weaker Royal Navy. Today's show was produced by Phil Hahn and it was researched by Augusto Pacheco and Sarah Fournier. And our studio manager was Bill Luty.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.